RN, your daily commute companion.
Good morning, I'm Michael Cathcart. Podcasters, radiophiles and lovers of the radio app, gather around your technology of choice because however you're listening, you're so very welcome to Books and Arts here on RN. Today, you and I are spending a fair deal of time in the theatre.
London calling through the faraway towns. Now war is declared and battle come down. London calling to the unknown.
You'll meet the fabulous scriptwriter Joe Penhall. He grew up in Australia, but London called.
It was like Alice in Wonderland. It was a different realm altogether where everybody wanted to be a playwright or wanted to find a playwright and encourage them and listen to them. And even now, playwrights are in the evening newspaper. It's surreal.
And back in Australia, we look at the state of theatre criticism. For whom do our critics speak? But first, books, TV, music and films. Why would anyone pay for them anymore?
All the free shit in the world will free your mind. All the free shit only free about half the time. All the free shit in the world will free your mind.
Yes, yes, it's all free. You can have it all for free. So copyright, why do we care about copyright anymore? Because copyright is vibrant in the New World Order. It's bloody. It's at the centre of passionate debates about whether we should be able to read and see and view and listen to everything for free. You've probably read the news recently of those pesky legal cases about who's downloaded the movie Dallas Buyers Club and what should happen to them. So why do we care? Well, I guess we care because copyright's all about making sure that artists and writers get paid for the work that they create. Now, the publisher Philippa McGuinness has convened a great forum on this issue. It's a book called Copy Fight, and she's with us now in our Sydney studio. Philippa, good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice to have you. So what is copyright?
Well, I think it's the glue that holds a lot of the creative industries together. It's as simple as that. You know, one of the contributors to the book says it's a form of codified respect. And I think that the best way to think about it is that when we have an arrangement between a creator, whether that person is a writer, a novelist, a songwriter, a playwright, a screenwriter, and somebody who's helping to get their work out there and ensure that they're remunerated, that's copyright. It's as simple as that.
So that's the moral argument for copyright, but just technically copyright is...
It's the right that a creator has in their own work.
Yeah, and it's automatic, isn't it? I mean, people often say to me, oh, I've written something but I haven't taken out copyright in it. And I say to them, well, you don't have to take out anything.
That's right.
You've just made it. It's yours.
Absolutely.
So... let's go back through your career. You're a well-known publisher. How has the state of copyright changed over the last, I don't know, 10, 15 years for you?
Well, it's interesting because I felt that in my own world, in some ways we were doing exactly what we had always done, except the form we were doing it in had changed. So we were still signing contracts with authors, but now contracts had clauses in them about digital publications or apps or whatever. So that had changed, but the principle was the same. You know, I still negotiated contracts with authors. We'd talk about whether we had English language rights or whether we would try and sell the rights to the book to other overseas territories. We'd talk about whether we had film rights and so on. All those basic principles remained absolutely the same. And if we wanted to use an image or a poem or a song in a book that we were publishing, we would seek out the copyright owners and clear the permission to use that work.
Yeah, and authors are very conscientious about this, and publishers are too. I mean, if you want to quote a bit of a poem at the, you know, the top of a chapter, often you'll have to apply to someone or other, unless it's out of copyright, of course, unless it's more than... What is it, 70 years since the creator
has
died?
That's right. When I started, it was 50, but the terms of copyright have mainly moved to 70.
Yes, it's now 70. So if you want to quote let's say WA Jordan, you've actually got to pay some money, and it might be $70, it might be $100, it won't be a lot, but you will have to pay money to someone to quote yes. Auden at the top of your chapter.
Yeah, you will. And I think, you know, to be honest, many of us feel better about paying living poets because they could do with the money. But, you know, we end up paying money to various estates and living artists around the world. But what I found was that while we were diligently doing all these things and acting with the respect that I think that we had always acted with, we would hear about pirated versions of books that we'd published on dodgy websites. And in conversation with friends who didn't necessarily work in publishing, they'd say, oh, I listened to that, this fantastic song. Oh, yeah, I just downloaded it. Or people would say, have you seen the latest episode of Breaking Bad or Game of Thrones? And I'd say, oh, I didn't think that was out yet, you know, naively. And they go, well, you can get everything now. You just torrent it.
People also talk as though the sort of younger generation, the kids who are still at school, they have access to this. But they're kind of in a universe where the rules are all different. And we as parents can somehow be the slightly mischievous beneficiaries of their know-how over there on the dark side.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. But what I've found is that a lot of the grown-ups aren't really behaving in a very grown-up-like way.
Grown-ups, that's such a publisher word. Oh, you grown-ups, you've got to look to yourself. I love this. Now, look, Philippa, I think we all know that people are downloading movies and music. Of course, music's been a topic, in this area for 20 years, I guess. But books, I mean, you're saying that books that you've published have shown up in unauthorised versions, are you?
Yeah, definitely. I would say that a lot of the sites where this happens, not all of them, of course, a lot of them are in Russia, but it's all over the place. And what you'll sometimes find is that the book itself might not be there in full, but it's a kind of lure to get people into a dodgy website.
But you say it's in Russia. I mean, with the greatest of respect to New South Publishing, it's hard to believe there's someone in Moscow who's monitoring your list.
I find it hard to believe too. I think it's not just us, Michael. You know, a lot of books get, you know, aggregated and put up illegally. But it's a big issue in educational publishing as well. You know, so students will and others, you know, access or facilitate textbooks that have been downloaded illegally.
Yep.
But there are all kinds of depressing sites that on Facebook, say, where authors write about, you know, trying to get copies of their novels taken down from somewhere. And it's distressing for authors. They do feel violated.
Yeah, you'd feel violated. And of course, how would you do it? If you're sitting in your little house somewhere in Australia and some anonymous person's put your stuff on a website, it's hard to know what you'd do without getting yourself into, you know, very expensive legal waters. The makers of the movie Dallas Buyers Club did decide to do something about this. They chased people who'd been downloading the movie illegally. And last month, the Australian Federal Court ordered the internet provider IINet to hand over details of customers who had illegally downloaded the movie. What are the implications of this ruling, Philippa, do you think?
Well, it's a little too early to tell because the federal court hasn't approved the wording of the letters that might be sent out to the violators.
Yeah,
the,
so they also
the copyright infringers.
So just to explain, they also made a ruling, which it was unusual, it seemed to me. Perhaps it's common, but it surprised me. The federal court also said that before IINet could send the letters out, they had to before the people who thought their copyright had been violated could send the letters out, they had to have those letters approved by the federal court.
Yes, that's right. And I'm not a lawyer. I don't know if that's standard practice, but it did seem a little unusual. But one reason why I was happy to hear about this decision wasn't so much because, you know, I like the idea of SWAT teams knocking on people's doors and, you know, demanding that they see all their, you know, illegal movies. Not that at all, but I just hoped that it might give some people pause and prompt them to think about, you know, the implications of illegal downloading, not least on the creators, the, you know, armies of creative types who are involved in making a film.
I mean, it wouldn't be so different from the days when the police used to raid communists' houses and walk out with army. One of the communists told me, walk out with any book that was bound in red.
Yeah.
He watched the police take away his copy of the poems of John Donne because they were bound in red.
Yeah. I mean, on one level, I agree, Michael, when you put it like that, it's kind of comic. You know, it's got this air of kind of, you know, Keystone Cops about it. But I don't think what we're talking about is censorship. You know, we're talking about the fact that, you know, movies or any kind of creative work needs to be financially viable. There's risk involved.
Actually, I didn't tell that story because I thought it was funny, although I did feel the funny side of it as I was unfolding it, I confess. But I actually embarked on the story because the point I was making was it's perfectly feasible for the police to raid people's houses.
Yeah,
it could come to that.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I guess that this decision has made people think, oh, isn't it okay to BitTorrent that? Everyone's doing it. Mm. Oh, that's right, it's illegal.
This is Books and Arts on RN with Michael Cathcart, and we're talking to the publisher, Philip McGuinness, about copyright because she's put together, well, a really wonderful forum of articles and thoughts in a book she's called Copy Fight. And I wonder, what do you think the federal court findings will do, or the federal court rulings will do? This is on the Dallas Buyers Club case, how that will change what you download. Has it changed your feelings about what you download? Are you now behaving differently because the court has said that the internet providers will have to hand over details of you to anyone who believes that you've been, or someone out there has been downloading their products illegally. If you head to ABCRN Books and Arts Facebook page, you can find us on Books and Arts. Just search for Facebook and Books and Arts, you'll find us there. And you can comment there. Of course, you can tweet us at RN Books and Arts. I'd love to know whether your downloading behaviour has changed, whether you're steaming on with your illegal activity, or whether you're thinking again, or whether you've never really done it, how you think about all this. Let's talk about this idea of big content, because the debate's often framed in terms of two shows in particular, Breaking Bad and Game of Thrones, and you write about the way this is often justified in terms of big content. Can you explain what that term means?
Yeah, I don't think it's a very useful term, but it is something, as you say, that gets thrown around quite a lot. It's obviously fairly derogatory because I think that many of the people who use the term big content are lumping a whole lot of different kind of creators in with big pharma or big tobacco, you know, as if we're all part of some giant entertainment industrial complex. And it makes me laugh to think that, you know, a non-profit independent publisher like the one I work for, or a small, you know, low-key songwriter, you know, or an independent television production company can be lumped in with not just, you know, the Motion Pictures Association of America, but the big tech companies as well.
I do understand this outlook because I used to, many, many years ago, I knew a guy who was a shameless shoplifter. But he wouldn't shoplift from the small corner store. He was very scrupulous about this. He wouldn't steal from people who owned the business. But big supermarkets, he was in there. He thought it was just a completely different world.
Yeah, I think that probably a lot of people now have the same kind of attitude. But having said that, when you look at a lot of fairly, you know, small Australian films that have been completely hammered by piracy, I'm not sure that all the pirates have that more nuanced view.
No. Well, I mean, you've got cases in your book of people who films where far more people have downloaded them than have actually bought a ticket. And you can see that this is actually jeopardising the commercial viability of the filmmaking industry. If more people are going to watch it for free than will actually pay to go and see it or to, you know, buy the video, you're buggered, really.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's not a very Radio National term, but it shows the depth of my feeling.
Yeah, well, I'm an optimist, Michael, so I hope we're not buggered. But I think that, you know, one of the points that John Birmingham makes in his chapter when he says, will we make a cultural desert and call it free? You know, it sounds perhaps alarmist to some people, but there is a cost here. And That's what I'm getting at.
Now, what about the other side of the ledger? What about the people who say artists themselves need to be able to borrow and subvert and build on what has gone before? And as the copyright lawyers find more and more areas where they can put up a fence and say, this is property, this is property, this is owned by somebody, as they become more and more diligent in finding, yes, copyright cases that they can fight, artists are actually being closed out of the creative use of the stuff that's in the zeitgeist.
Yeah, it's a paradox because there's no getting around the fact that we live in a kind of a remix world. And I think that's great. It is exciting to be able to build on what's gone before and sample it and so on. I think that a lot of the existing laws are more flexible than a lot of people would have you believe. Now, I preempt this by saying I'm not a lawyer, but I think that there is a lot of creative energy that even the fair dealing provisions within the current legislation allow. And the other thing is that...
Just to explain that fair dealing allows you to use some things, perhaps a little bit of some things, if it's considered to be fair dealing. And a classic example of this is criticism. If you're criticising somebody, writing a commentary on their work, you can quote them at will. But there are also other little windows of opportunity where you can use people's stuff within fair dealing. But it's a slightly, ill-defined area, Philip. But people have been caught up very badly by being sued in situations which did look to them like fair dealing. I mean, the Men at Work case is the famous one.
Yeah, it is. I, you know, to be really honest, find that case really depressing. And one of, actually, a lawyer does write about that in the book. I don't think that the Kookaburra decision was particularly helpful for anyone. But a lot of the creators in the book say...
Just to remind people, this is about the song, We Come From a Land Down Under, and it had a little riff in it, a flute riff, that was quoting Kookaburra Sits in the Old Gum Tree. And the copyright in that song was owned by a guy who'd, you know, bought up copyrights, and he then sued the band for this riff, and he won at the cost of... some millions of dollars. He claimed, money from the royalties they'd earned on the song.
Yeah, that's right. But a lot of creators, I think, would say, I just wish someone would ask me. I'd say yes, but it'd be nice to be asked.
Mm. Just as we wind up, as we started by saying, copyright used to last 50 years from the creator's death. Now it's blown out to 70 years. Do you think that's too long?
Yes, I do. I do. I think that you want living creators and their immediate family to benefit from their work, but I think when a lot of things end up locked for a long time, for longer than 50 years after a creator's death, I don't welcome that.
Yeah, we're getting copyright passing down to the second generation, aren't
That's
we, to
right.
the grandchildren.
Yes.
Or owned by corporations who never even met the artist.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Well, look, it's a fantastically interesting collection you've put together. It's really vibrant and feisty, and it's been lovely to talk to you, Philippa. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much, Michael.
Philippa McGuinness is a publisher at New South Publishing House, and she's edited this collection and written a terrific introduction. It's called Copy Fight, and all sorts of well-known people are there having their say about where they stand on the copyright issues. And Philippa and other writers from this collection will be taking part in an extended discussion about all these things with Paul Barclay on Big Ideas here on RN. That's in about a month's time, and I'll let you know when that'll be going to air. On RN, this is Books and Arts. Next up, screenwriter Joe Penhall.
Taxman's taken all my dough and left me in my stately home, blazing on a sunny afternoon, and I can't sail my yacht.
Sunday afternoon, a hit song for the British band The Kinks in 1966. It's the title track of a hit West End musical, which this month has taken home four gongs in Britain's Olivier Awards. The script for the musical, or what they call the book, is by Joe Penhall. And Joe was born in London. He grew up in Australia, and these days he divides his time between London, Los Angeles and Melbourne, working in film and theatre and in TV. He first entered my consciousness about 13, 14 years ago with a riveting play called Blue Orange. It premiered at Britain's National Theatre in 2000 and then came to Australia shortly after that. And since then, there's been a string of highly successful scripts for theatre and for screen that have made him one of the leading scriptwriters in work today. And he's in Melbourne, where he's been talking about his work and running workshops with writers and meeting people the length and breadth of that great city. Joe, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Nice to have you here. So you were born in London in 1967. Yep. You went to Perth, then you went to Adelaide. You worked as a muso for a while in Sydney, and then you headed to London. When did the playwriting start?
When everything else finished, really. When I felt like I'd sort of run out of road, the only thing left to do was what I'd always really wanted to do, was try being a writer. And in London, they really encourage playwriting. And the theatres like the Royal Court, they try and take young people and groom them and make them into writers.
Listener, the Royal Court sounds like a flash place called the Royal Court, but actually it's this vigorous theatre with a very classy address, but this vigorous theatre where young playwrights, often radical playwrights with a bit of an edge to them, actually get a serious workout.
Yeah, and when I started, there wasn't any resources or money. There was just enough to pay the writers, and everything was kind of faded and knackered. And we had a little tiny building in the Portobello Road where the young writers learnt. They were taught by older writers. It was very industrious, you know, and it was considered to be an art form, but also a profession and a business. And you could learn and you could be taught, and then you got on the ladder and you earned a living and got an accountant and, you know.
And here you are.
Here you are.
And did you feel, Joe, that you had gone into a different kind of culture, a culture where the status of the writer was different from what you'd known in Australia?
Yeah, completely different. It was like Alice in Wonderland. It was a different realm altogether, where everybody wanted to be a playwright or wanted to find a playwright and kind of raise them and pay them and encourage them and listen to them. And it's even now, you know, playwrights are in the evening newspaper, you know, in the Evening Standard. Yeah. You're on page three. It's surreal. It's completely different over here.
I just don't understand why there isn't an Australian writers' theatre.
There's a lot of reasons. I think one really simple reason that everyone can understand is that, you know, it's down to kind of, in England, it's in the cultural heritage. You know, Shakespeare, who I've never been a great fan of, but because he's there and he was, you know, so stitched into the kind of infrastructure, you know, hundreds of years ago, that's their cultural heritage. He's very, very important. Playwrights are very important because of that.
I mean, the English feel as though they own theatre, as though they invented theatre. The Greeks were just a kind of dry run, really.
Definitely the Royal Court feels that the Royal Court and John Osborne invented modern playwriting.
Yeah.
You know, in 1956 with Look Back in Anger.
Well, Look Back in Anger is spoken of in England in the way, I guess, we talk about Summer of the 17th Doll.
Yeah, absolutely. Revolutionary.
Yeah. You know. Well, as I say, I discovered your work with this.
They're blue oranges.
Blue oranges, really?
Bright blue.
Peel one, see what's inside. What colour is it inside?
It's blue.
So the skin is blue, and even underneath the skin, it's the same. It's blue.
That's correct. Bright blue, completely blue. It's bad. It's a bad orange, don't eat it. You know what I mean? My God, what is it, black magic?
Voodoo.
Oh, no, spooky.
Yeah, that's from your play Blue Orange, which I've seen twice on stage and once on film. So it's about a young black man called Chris who's suffering from schizophrenia, and he believes, among other things, that his father is the African dictator Idi Amin. And the two doctors who are trying to treat him end up in a kind of treacherous power struggle. It's a three-way drama, really, and really the patient comes off third best in this power struggle. Now, well, you've said recently that the key to a good play is aboutness.
What the play is about is our first kind of point of contact with it, and we're living in an age where we're so bombarded with interesting little juicy snippets and stories and what have you, And we're sifting through different things that are about different things all day. So we're not so focused on going to a play that's like Beckett or that's like Arthur Miller. We're much more focused on just on what's it about. Theatre is, luckily it's still big business in England, but increasingly what I've noticed is that, plays are received according to what they're about. You know, is what it's about very exciting and engaging to us? And so for years I thought Blue Orange was a great piece of writing, and I was, you know, fated and everything. And it really, it's only just dawned on me quite recently that really it's because what it was about was so engaging. It was so irresistible, you know. And
so it's about mental illness.
Well, more specifically, it's about somebody who thinks that they're something else entirely, and they might be right. You know, it's a very intriguing little sort of proposition. But yeah, also it was about mental illness at a time when the world was just starting to sort of learn that this was everywhere and it was on our streets, and our governments were cultivating a crisis by letting people out of mental hospitals, right, and closing down resources.
This is a classic issue, I reckon, a classic challenge for writers, because I mean, it's incredible how often people have sat where you sit and say, I don't want to write political theatre, because political theatre is predictable. You know, it has a kind of pat answer, ban the bomb, or, you know, let's not pollute the planet. And everybody knows what's going to happen. We're going to end up with either a polluted planet when everybody dies, or the rebels will win and hooray, we'll all cheer. So there's no real drama in it, because all you're doing is delivering a message. And then the next breath they'll say, but I want my theatre to be about something. I want it to make people think. I want to confront them with, you know, what the planet's all about. I don't want what society's all about. I don't want to write a play that's just about theatre, that's just about fine speaking.
One of your responsibilities is to address the world and what's going on in it. And the tension between that being your responsibility and that being something that you sometimes want to do, and then that being something that you sometimes don't want to do, that tension is something that's in play all the time. And some plays are more obviously about the world around me, and some plays are more obviously about myself or my family. But that tension is always in play. That's why you need to have an acute sense of aboutness and be aware of it.
On RN, this is Books and Arts, and I'm Michael Cathcart, and you and I are getting to know the writer, the scriptwriter, Joe Penhall, who's in Australia for a brief visit. He works in England. He lives in England. He was born there, but he spent some time as an Australian, I guess. Yeah, you're an Australian for a while.
I'm both.
Are you?
I've got both passports, and when I'm here, I'm an Australian, and when I'm in London, I'm a card-carrying.
That's a lovely trick to be able to perform.
It's magical, yeah.
All things to all men, you are.
I like to be able to go where I want to go and do what I want to do.
He's a man's man. Now, what's this thing you've got with Idi Amin? Because in Blue Orange, you've got this guy, the young black man, Chris, who's this mental patient, who thinks his father is Idi Amin. Then you spent 6 years writing a film adaptation of a novel called The Last King of Scotland, which is all about a Scottish doctor who was doctor to Idi Amin. You've got a TV series, Moses Jones, which seems to have a fair bit to do with people who once hung out with Idi Amin. What is it with you and Idi Amin?
The short answer is that, you know, I just remember when I was a kid, my dad was South African, and there was a period of time when we were almost going to move to Kenya. I grew up with Africanness in the household, you know, and without realizing it. And then many years later, a producer gave me the book of Last King of Scotland, which is about somebody who meets Idi Amin. And the book resonated on an incredibly deep, subliminal level with me and made me very emotional. My dad was dying at the time. And so I desperately wanted to do the book. And then I got fascinated with Idi Amin. And he seemed to be both something of the past, but also something of the future. You know, there was a bit of Saddam Hussein in him. It just kind of ticked a lot of boxes. So I wrote that film. I spent 5 or 6 years writing that and went to Uganda and met all Idi Amin's henchmen. And, you know, he's a fascinating character, and all the people around him are fascinating. I met his psychiatrist, who said he confirmed for me that he was paranoid schizophrenic, which really nobody knew, and that he wouldn't take his medication, which kind of led to genocide. It was endlessly fascinating. And then I rewrote the film, and they didn't want my version of the film, and someone else came in and rewrote it, and someone else came in and rewrote his rewrite, and the film that came out is the film we've got. I took my name off it. So I had all this kind of incredibly hard-boiled information and all these wonderful stories that I couldn't use. You know, I met the guys in the Suicide Band, which is a band that he loved and went to see every night, and eventually he shot the bass player and married the backing singer. She became his fifth wife. I mean, it's an endlessly epic, you know, story. And so Moses Jones was partly about a band of Africans in London. And
Moses Jones is the TV series you wrote subsequently.
This deposed African dictator keeps coming and seeing them every night. And the dilemma that that causes. It was just a big pot of ideas that I was able to dip into several times. And had a very close connection with, probably, as I say, because my dad was essentially African, you know.
When this film that you'd written, The Last King of Scotland, went sour, I mean, I can imagine this is a bitter, distressing experience for you. Was that something you had to struggle to come back from? Because as you've told the story, this is a passion for you, this film, and then other people come along and basically take it off you and turn it into something they want. Was it hard to pick yourself up, or were you fired with fury to just go on writing?
It was very, very hard, actually, because I was so invested in it. You know, there was so much of myself in it, and my connection to it was my dad, who had recently passed away. So I'd invested it with way too much kind of blood, sweat and tears. And I made sure that I never did that again, because they moved on and found other people. They really didn't care what it meant to me.
Or what the film was about for you.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, they asked me to do things like, you know, it's the 70s and he had a Maserati. Where's the scene with, you know, driving the Maserati? Where's the, you know, the girls in the jacuzzi and all that kind of stuff? So it was my first experience of never mix business with pleasure, you know. Never think that this is a cathartic thing that's going to chime with your soul, because it's business.
You like plays with just three or four characters. I mean, when you write a film like that, you can have as many characters as you want, really. But you seem to like sort of muscular plays with just a few people on stage. What's that about?
I think because it's simple, you know. I love the simple plays. The plays that always really excited me were very simple and very small, whether it was Beckett or Mamet, you know, or Pinter. Those are the guys that I loved. People noticed it in my writing, and it just seemed to work very, very well.
It's odd that it works, isn't it? Because in a way it's totally implausible. You know, you create a world in which there are three people and maybe someone else on the phone, or you know, someone's mother who's spoken of but who never appears. But basically you can hold an audience with a story that's premised on the fact that in the world of this play there are just four people.
Yeah, and not an awful lot happens, and there's not an awful lot of event and stuff like that. What does happen is very nuanced and very delicate. And, you know, in Blue Orange, they argue back and forth, and they, bit by bit, they deal out different nuances and different aspects of the argument, and it's very thorough. And by the end of the night, you've got the whole kind of meal from soup to nuts. It might be that I'm relatively obsessive, you know, and an argument, I want to know every facet of the argument. And when I have an argument, I want to be able to have the entire argument with all its subtleties and nuances. And theatre is the only place where you're kind of allowed to do that. With film, you have to keep moving on. You tell the story in cuts, you know. It's often about what you don't say. Theatre allows you to indulge that. So if you're obsessively interested in something and you want to explore it, you know, to the hilt, then you can do that.
On RN, my guest this morning is the writer Joe Penhall. Joe, I often think that, for the writer at least, theatre is a very public medium. It's about very public stuff. It's very rare that I see a good play that's based on a writer's introspection. You know, you write a novel or a memoir that's very autobiographical. A very autobiographical play is a rare beast.
Mm.
Do you think that's true? That the play is about, well, it's aboutness, takes you out of yourself into stuff that's in the public sphere?
Well, I think that the thing about plays is that they have to sort of do both. They have to be something that the public can engage with, because it's the public that's going to come and watch them. And you have to hold their interest without letting them out the door, you know, for 2 hours. But it wouldn't be any good, and you wouldn't be able to write it unless you yourself engage with it on a very personal level. So for me, the great plays are the plays that do both, whether it's Death of the Salesman, you know, or Waiting for Godot, or, you know, contemporary hits like Closer. They do both. They somehow locate something that's in the ether that's important to people. But they are also quite obviously, if you know the writer, they're obviously born of their personal obsessions and who they are.
I can't let you go without asking you about Sunny Afternoon. So This is what the industry calls a jukebox musical, I guess. You've already got the songs. You've got all the songs that the Kinks ever recorded, I suppose. And you build a story that somehow works, and the emotional points of rest or the emotional climaxes come on the songs, I suppose, is how you've done it. How did this come about, that you would do a musical on the Kinks?
Well, I always wanted to do a musical about the Kinks, and I always wanted to write a play about a very young rock and roll band. I'd always loved the Kinks. I found the Kinks, Ray Davies' songs, to be kind of uniquely introspective and articulate, kind of like monologues, in a way that the Stones or the Who or the Clash or Coldplay are just not. So I went to see a solo show of Ray's in 1996, and I put a note in his dressing room saying, hey, if you ever want to collaborate, I'm around. And of course, didn't hear back from him. And then a couple of years ago, he went to a producer and said, I want to write a musical, you know, can you find me a playwright? And the producer rang me and sounded me out. And then we all got together in a cafe and talked about it. And about a week later, Ray rang and said, look, I'd love you to do this. So it only took 17 years, but but it was worth it.
It's been worth it. Yes, it's just one for Olivier's in London. And the season just keeps getting extended.
Yeah.
Selling tickets through to the end of this year, I gather.
Yeah, they are. And there's a woman who's seen it 56 times. And the other night we had a little ceremony for her on stage because it was her 50th time. And there are people that have seen it multiple times. It's in quite a small theatre, 600-seat theatre, but it's got a fanatical following.
Well, you've got so much still on your slate. I gather you're writing a werewolf film for Ridley Scott. You work on a Western with Sam Mendes. You work on a series for HBO about the FBI.
The werewolf film and the Western Bit the Dust.
Oh, the Bit the Dust?
Yeah.
Oh, well, that's the sign of a great writer. He had a lot on your slate. That's a shame, a werewolf film. That would have been fun.
Yeah, look, I wanted to do that as well because I like to be very different every time. I kind of like to be chameleonic and go to the opposite extreme. So I had a lot of fun writing that. And I think in the end, the author of the book got a very tempting offer to turn it into a long-running TV series.
Ah,
which was very lucrative.
Yes, which is where the energy is.
Yeah, and the Sam Mendes thing, the Western, it was a rights issue again. You know, the person that held the rights to the book that this was based on got a very lucrative offer to do something else with it. And Sam wasn't prepared to match that extortionate offer, and probably rightly so.
Still, these are the stories, the disappointments that beset you when you're a player.
It's what makes you good, you know, what hurts.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah, see, playwrights should talk like this. Footballers always talk like this. Yeah, you're hurting, it's good.
Exactly.
A champion is a man who gets up when he can't, Joe.
Well, absolutely. You know, you find out about somebody when it all goes wrong. You know, character is all about what you do when it all goes wrong, and when you fail, anybody can have a great character, an upstanding character, and be a nice person, decent when everything's going right. That's easy.
It's been good to talk to you, Joe. Thanks for coming in.
Very good to talk to you too. Thank you.
Joe Penhall is the London-based writer, a London-based writer. He's very much in demand. His musical Sunny Afternoon is now playing in London, and it's just won 4 Olivier Awards. And you might like to hunt out the film version of his 2000 play Blue Orange, although given what we were saying earlier, you might find that it's easier to find online than perhaps it ought to be.
On the music show this weekend, we meet Kate Moore. She's the composer in residence at the Canberra International Music Festival, which is now up and running. And we talk to Father Ivan Moody. He's a composer, writer, and an Orthodox priest. And we're going to talk about spirituality and musical modernism. That's Kate Moore on Saturday morning and Ivan Moody on 7, both at our new time of 11 o'clock here on RN.
With Andy Ford, of course. I never miss Andy on a Friday, on a Saturday. And now on a Sunday, we get to hear him twice. What a marvellous thing. Now, I asked for your feedback on the court case about the Dallas Buyers Club, the movie The Dallas Buyers Club. The federal court just recently ordered internet provider IINet to hand over details of its customers who were illegally downloading the movie so that the owners of the copyright to Dallas Buyers Club could track them down. And I asked you whether this would change your behaviour. So Simon's written into the Books and Arts website. He says, I work in the film industry, and out of respect for my craft and filmmakers in general, I don't download content without paying for it. But I have a difficult time admonishing my friends. What a wonderful word, admonishing my friends, many of whom are insatiable consumers of illegally obtained film, for two reasons. The first is that the back catalogue of world cinema is... The first is that the back catalogues of world cinema are virtually non-existent. It's almost impossible to purchase for viewing on demand most cinema classics. Solaris is simply not available to buy, let alone more recent films. I'm not sure about that, Simon. I've got Solaris. I've got a rather expensive, I must say, box set of Tarkovsky, which someone gave me. So you can get it, but you've got to really fork out for that one. Secondly, the distributors who do make content available are so... are so heinously greedy, often taking upward of 50% of the purchase cost. Hard to convince people they should contribute to the Apple profit margin. Thank you, Simon, for getting in touch with us about that issue. And do keep that conversation coming. You can talk to us on our website and you can talk to us on the Arts Facebook page. Let's have a sting.
I don't like it. I love it, love it, love it. Uh-oh. So good it hurts. I don't want it. I gotta, gotta have it. Uh-oh. When I can't find the words, I just go.
I don't like it. I love it by Flo Rida, which is spelt like the American state, but not pronounced like the American state. Now, I'm sure many theatre directors would love to hear their plays reviewed like that. I don't like it, I love it. But often theatre criticism isn't as glowing or as short. What is the current state of play in Australian theatre criticism? Are we fostering emerging critics? Do we have a truly national theatre critic at all who can put plays in a national context? Well, let's hear from two people who know what life is like on both sides of a theatre review. One is a critic. Actually, she's also a playwright. And the other is a director. Van Badham is Guardian Australia's award-winning critic, and she's also a theatre maker, so she has been on both sides of the fence. Good morning.
Good morning, Michael.
Nice to have you here. And Sam Strong is with us. He is the Associate Artistic Director at the Melbourne Theatre Company. You can't just nod. You have to say good morning. I mean,
I was smiling and laughing on the inside. No, I was politely waiting for the good morning, but good morning. Thank you for having me.
That was the weirdest moment in radio I think I've had. The second weirdest moment in radio was 10 seconds ago when all the lights went out. We should tell Australia we're talking to each other in the dark.
Or should at least put my pants back on.
Yes. Oh, good.
Samuel.
Oh, that would be good. Oh, I know. He's a racy theatre type.
I know.
I wonder whether this is one of the new efficiencies. Are the lights going to go out here at the ABC for an hour every day in order to save money? That would be a good idea. They've taken away the water cooler out there. No one delivers the mail anymore. Now they're switching the lights off for an hour a day.
It's the tumbling tumbleweed through the foyer, which I think is the real hallmark of a decaying
that
civilization.
Gives it away. Do we have a robust culture of theatre criticism in Australia right now? That's the question. Van?
Well, I think we have a very interesting theatre criticism culture. Certainly, we've seen the rise of some really young and really interesting critics. And I mentioned specifically my Guardian stablemate, Jane Howard, who is very young, who's from Adelaide, who already I think Jane's barely in her mid-20s, has, because she is an Adelaide resident, been exposed to international high practice art of the greatest calibre since she was a very young person.
Because of the festival.
So we've got a rise because of the festival culture in Australia and, the Perth Festival, Adelaide Festival, Sydney, Melbourne, Brisbane, and now what's happening down in Tasmania with, of course, Dark Mofo, that we're seeing a younger generation of people who are interested and engaged with the arts, who are developing an incredible theatrical literacy while they are still young. So as emerging critics, they have quite a broad and challenging context for which to understand new work. And I think that's really exciting. I should mention, of course, even though Jane is one of my favourite critics, she and I to date have never agreed on a single thing that we have seen. And
so why should we believe anything you say?
Well, I mean, criticism is always a process of subjective evaluation. As a critic, I'm motivated by two principles. Is it original and is it well done? I try very, very hard not to review my own taste because as a critic, I think that my role within the discourse...
But hang on, you just said it was subjective evaluation.
Well, it is subjective evaluation because, of course, what I evaluate to be high craft and well executed, other people may disagree. And this is the thing about criticism, and this is why a robust culture is so important.
Well, a robust culture then needs to mean that we have access to several theatre critics, that you don't just have one person sitting on a paper reviewing everything in that town.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And I think with the rise of the internet, we've seen the promotion of diverse voices and a democratized community of criticism. That's actually really interesting.
But not paid.
Well, not always, which is, you know, a terrible shame.
Well, maybe we don't need paid critics anymore. Maybe the democratization of the internet means that you, people like you no longer need to draw a salary because we've got all this conversation.
I'm an expert communicator, Mr. Cathcart. I think that my skills at communicating and the context that I bring to my profession should be rewarded. Absolutely, I do. I would say that for all critics. If you're a publisher, you should be paying your writers. I think that's the fundamental principle here. But certainly when it comes to criticism, like I said, my priorities are, is it well executed and is it original? Other critics aren't as interested in the originality element of new work. Other critics are interested in, you know, does it fulfil its mission merely to be entertaining? A lot of critics are interested in things that replicate other forms. Me, as a practitioner and a person who's interested in the discourse of art and artistic practice, which is always about making it new and finding new ways of exploring form and new ways of observing humanity and the human condition, my interest is in originality. And I've seen shows that, on an aesthetic level, are not my thing, which I've given very good reviews to because I can recognise that within their context, they're perfectly executed and they're completely original. Yeah. But that doesn't, I'm not there to review my own taste. If you want to know whether I like something, you can have a look at my face 5 minutes after the show. But if you're reading something I write for The Guardian, I have a responsibility to my readership locate work in context.
Since Van is not going to breathe, I'm just going to cut across
looking
it.
I love talking about criticism. I love it.
What do you think? Do you think there is a robust? I mean, you're a director.
Yeah.
Do you despair? Do you think, oh, my God, I put on a play, but those critics are going to come and they know nothing, they're going to write these things about me? Or do you think there is a vibrant culture?
I think there is a vibrant culture. I think there's a varied culture from city to city. But I think, to take your other point about me being a director, I can't, in the same way that Van's talking about the relationship between subjectivity and objectivity, I can't cease to be a human being as an artist when I'm responding to criticism. And it is you know, difficult when you plough 6 months' worth of work into something and someone tells you that it's not very good. And that's you know, one needs to develop a thick skin. But I think it's also, you can't help but be a human being. But I probably wear a number of hats in that relationship, in that as an artist, as an artist, I would probably not necessarily engage that much with reviews of my work.
But so you don't read them?
I actually have a case-by-case approach.
He reads them.
No, and I think actually a lot of people genuinely don't read them. But I think the other hat that I wear, of course, is with my role at the Melbourne Theatre Company. So I think as an artistic leader in a city, I have a responsibility to the culture of that city to read them and to understand the culture and to understand the ecology in which I'm making work. And I think that's, for me, what defines really great criticism is that it acknowledges that it too plays a role in a theatrical culture. And I think where criticism goes wrong and ceases to be robust enough, or indeed becomes too robust, is where it becomes unnecessarily adversarial. Mm.
Now let's talk about that, because there is a style of criticism, and it goes way back, it's nothing new, where the critic prides him or herself on the ability to say the wounding thing, to come up with a really smart and funny remark that makes the artist look like an idiot. And we all know what we're talking about. Is that just part of the game? I mean, some people say to me, look, if you've got a big show in town, you're a big player, you're a grown-up boy or girl, you've just got to be able to take it, because that's the way the world works.
Yes, and absolutely, that's one of the hallmarks of criticism. And I think as a critic, it's very tempting to engage in, you know, the critical politics of envy. I mean, if we're looking at a show or a film or, you know, a piece of art, we're looking at talented, insightful people with a platform to
who have the opportunities
and the platform to express
but
their
creative
selves.
But sometimes it's not envy. Sometimes you're cross because you've sat there. I mean, the three of us know that there is no more painful art form than the theatre when it's bad.
Oh,
you can watch
absolutely.
Bad television and think, this is crap, but I'm just going to keep watching. You can look at bad paintings and think, oh, well, I'll just go to the cafe. But to be stuck in a theatre when the play is just not speaking to you, it's just ghastly.
It is. It's really difficult. But I think certainly that, you know, what I try and bring from my experience on the other side of the line as a practitioner is an appreciation and a context of the work and the artist that gets brought to the stage. It's frustrating as a critic when you see people who you have enormous amounts of artistic respect for underperforming. For me, the most painful thing is to watch really talented people trapped in a production that is not working.
You know,
that's really frustrating.
I always find it hard when the critic blames people for what's gone wrong because no one tried to get it wrong. And I mean, honestly, you never try to act badly or direct badly. You never want to muck it up.
And those questions of attribution are really, really difficult. I mean, when you're within a work, questions of who is responsible for what are very difficult and nuanced questions. So I think to actually come into a work from the outside and make a comment on that can be quite problematic. But I think the other thing for me is it comes back to, I think, the intention and the ideology, if you like, of the reviewer going in. I think if someone has a genuine love of the art form and someone genuinely wants a work to succeed, then they can be as robust. They can tear strips off a work if they feel like that work is not meeting the artistic standards that they wanted to. I think there are certain professional and respectful lines that I think need to be drawn. My test is often, I think if a critic could sit opposite the person that they're reviewing and read it to them and have a completely clear conscience, then I think that's actually not a bad test.
Van, I'm not a critic and I've rarely worked as a critic and I haven't enjoyed doing it when I have. But I really thought about the role of the critic the day I saw The Boy from Oz. So I was in the theatre and I really just didn't like it. I didn't like anything about it. I didn't enjoy it. I wanted to go home. And at the end, the audience just went off. They erupted. They were just euphoric. And I thought, well, okay, this wasn't my night. I just wasn't seeing the same show as everybody else. Have you ever had that experience of sitting there thinking, gee, I'm just not enjoying this, and the audience has gone mental?
Absolutely. So I've absolutely had that experience.
So what do you do?
Well, I remove my own aesthetic criteria and I look objectively at the work, which as a critic I see it as my responsibility to study the art form and have an expert knowledge of it. I mean, I'm very well trained to do what I do. I have 4 degrees in various forms of theatre practice and insight, and I have to take my own, like I said, take my own taste out of it and look at what is going right, what is going wrong on a technical and performative level, and evaluate where the work sits within an evolving discourse of practice as well. I mean, there are art forms that really do nothing for me. There are writers who don't speak to, you know, the calibrations of my soul. Mm. But, I mean, I like criticism because as a practitioner, I find criticism a good way of understanding, you know, the biases within my own theatre practice as an artist. But I also like theatre criticism because I love performance and I love the theatre and I particularly love the Australian arts community and those moments when you see people who you have this contextual knowledge and history and understanding of firing on all cylinders is the most exhilarating experience as a critic, as an artist, as a citizen.
You know what I miss in theatre criticism is there seem to be two modes in any review. One is a description of the show and then the final paragraph which says thumbs up or thumbs down. What I want actually is analysis, is discussion, is some kind of intellectual to create a new work, actually, that sits alongside the theatre thing we've just seen, that is a piece of thoughtful writing that will stimulate discussion either about the art form or about the issues it raises.
I think that's one of the great difficulties of the current state of theatre criticism. And I think we all have this sort of nostalgia, and I share your nostalgia for when people wrote in more longer form ways about work. But I think to phrase what's happened or what's changed in a positive fashion, I think what's been interesting about the evolution of criticism is that you now have an enormous amount more commentary. Yes, most of that commentary is in much shorter form, but you have a lot more commentary on the work that you've made than you used to have 10 years ago. And so, you know, if you think of what's coming in through social media, what's coming in through Twitter, as well as more official reviewing channels, mainstream and online.
Well, we will continue this conversation in another program. Been marvellous to meet you both. Well, not meet you both. Have you back?
I'm back.
Lovely
you
to
back.
See you again, Michael.
Thank you for having us.
I can't remember what you look like because we're talking to each other in the dark, but I'm sure you're looking as peachy as ever. Van Badham is The Guardian Australia's theatre critic, and she's also an award-winning writer. And Sam Strong is the Associate Artistic Director at the Melbourne Theatre Company. And I'll be in conversation with Catherine Brisbane tonight at our Melbourne studios, the ABC studios at Southbank. If you head to our website, you can get a ticket there. It's almost sold out, so you need to be quick if you're in Melbourne. And we'll be broadcasting that conversation here on Books and Arts this coming Thursday. And as always, I would love to hear your views. Just jump onto our Facebook site or talk to us on Twitter. I'd love to know what you think about theatre criticism, whether you think it's going well, going badly. What do you want from a critic? That's the key issue, isn't it? What do you want from a critic? Now, tomorrow on the show, Sofia Tolstoy, the wife of the great Russian author Leo Tolstoy. Her novella, published in English for the first time. Actually, it's two stories that have just been published in English for the first time. And we'll find out why it's recently only come to light. The author's family, the Tolstoy family, apparently didn't want it published for quite some time. The news is next, and then Earshot, we journey to 19th century France, when women simply didn't go on voyages of exploration. But that didn't stop Rose de Freycinet. She dressed up as a woman and went off to the Pacific, and she wrote a diary all about it. That's coming up after the news. I'm Michael Cathcart, and this is RN, where the lights are still out. Bye for now.
I hate Taylor Swift. You're a casual racist, leftist, rightist. Oh, look, cat video. There it is, the life online. On the Sunday Extra podcast this week, we ask, why is there so much outrage on the internet? And what does that do to the quality of our social conversation? Our outsiders are in, and First Dog on the Moon is locked up. Join me, Jonathan Green. You can stream or download the program at the RN website.